own area of research, interests, and expertise is on the origins of the New Testament, particularly the New Testament canon. So tonight's going to be more of a sermon at the 7 o'clock service, and it's going to be a real worship service. This session now, we thought might be interesting to look at some more historical questions. So tonight's going to be more about sort of the central place that God's Word has in our life as believers. In this hour, though, I want to look at a different issue. In this hour, I want to ask the question about how we got our New Testaments. And I want to look particularly at this question of what do we do with all these so-called lost books out there that we hear about? And if you've been a believer for even a short time or a long time, depending on your situation, you know about these sorts of things. You hear about these so-called lost gospels or hidden gospels, and the, you know, archaeologists and scholars find these, and then Christians come and ask me, hey, what do we do with these? How do we think about these lost books? And what do we make of them? And why is our culture so fascinated with these things? Well, that's going to be our topic for this session today. And so what I want to explore with you is this whole phenomenon of lost gospels, and actually use this time to offer sort of my case, if you will, for why our four gospels belong in our New Testaments as opposed to other books. So what you're going to hear from me tonight is sort of my very brief four-part answer to why our gospels are distinctive, why Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John belong in our Bibles and not something, say, like the Gospel of Peter or the Gospel of Philip or something like this. So that's what we're going to be doing tonight. So hopefully this will be helpful for you on a number of levels. One level I hope that this helps you with is encourage you in your own walk with Christ. The more you can be convinced that the Bible is God's Word, that it's authoritative, that it makes sense, that it was put together with some sort of rationale, that can help you in your own walk. But I actually have another goal for tonight, and that is, as you leave here, I hope you have a sense of what makes our Gospels unique so that you can talk to your non-Christian friends about that, right? When they ask you, well, hold on a second, why do we have Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John in our New Testaments as opposed to these other books? Hopefully you'll have at least a little bit more of an answer to that question when you leave rather than when you showed up. So that's my goal tonight. And then I hope before we're done, I can open up for some questions. I always actually find that the most interesting thing. If it was up to me, we'd just go straight to questions. I don't know. I don't know if I can do that, Brent, but hopefully I'll give my session, and then we'll open it up for questions, and you can answer questions or ask questions rather about what I said or maybe anything else related to biblical authority that you have on your mind tonight. So that is our plan this evening. So I'll tell you what, let me just say a word of prayer as we get started, and we'll ask God to bless our time together, and then we'll dive right in. Let's pray. Lord, we're grateful for this chance to think upon these things. Thank you for these men and women coming out and spending some time pondering these things. May that be a blessing to them and a blessing to those they talk to going forward. So we commit it to you in Christ's name. Amen. Okay, if we're going to talk about lost gospels, I want to start in a rather unusual place tonight. Actually, I want to start by talking first about Muhammad Ali. Now, I know when you hear that, you're thinking, good gracious, what kind of lecture is this, right? You know, you think you show up to hear about lost gospels, and we're talking about the boxer Muhammad Ali. What in the world is that all about? Well, actually, I don't want to talk about the boxer Muhammad Ali. I want to talk about the shepherd Muhammad Ali. In fact, the shepherd Muhammad Ali, you've never even heard of. You probably don't even know his story, but it's a fascinating story. In 1945... a shepherd by the name of Muhammad Ali was digging on his farm in the middle of the desert, effectively, outside a little town called Nag Hammadi, Egypt. You probably even know where that is, but it's in the Upper Nile region of Egypt. And there he is digging in his field for fertilizer, and he's with his brother. And this is something they typically do to make the crops grow better and so forth. And he's digging in the ground, and he hits something hard. Thanks, well, that's odd. What is this? So he clears away the dirt. And almost like something out of a movie, he pulls out a masonry jar out of the ground. And it's sealed on the top, and he's thinking to himself, what in the world could be in this jar? And of course, if you lived in Nag Hammadi, Egypt in 1945, and you were a shepherd, you're thinking to yourself, well, I hope treasure's in this jar, right? I hope, you know, some sort of jewels or money or something. Maybe I've struck gold effectively. And certainly that's what Muhammad Ali wished had happened. And so he's about to crack the jar open, and his brother stops him and says, wait. You may not want to do that. There could be an evil genie inside that might curse us. So they really had a conversation about an evil genie for a while and finally decided, well, the potential for gold here in this particular jar outweighs evil genies. So they ended up cracking open the jar. And as they cracked open this jar, Muhammad Ali and his brother were profoundly disappointed because they didn't find gold, they didn't find jewels, Gladly, they didn't find an evil genie. What they did find, actually, were books. Actually, they found 13 different books, what we call codices, or part of a codex, which is the type of book in the ancient world. And inside those 13 codices were 52 different stories. And if only Muhammad Ali had known what he found. He didn't. He ended up selling these books for just a few dollars to a local antiquities dealer, and then they were sold, and then sold again, and sold again. And eventually, they found their ways into biblical scholars' hands, and they realized what they had found is maybe one of the greatest archaeological discoveries of the whole modern era. What he found, they didn't realize it, is what later became known as the Gnostic Gospels. The Gnostic Gospels are a collection of writings that date back all the way to the early period of Christianity, 2nd, 3rd, 4th century, that have a very different feel about Christianity when we read them. These 52 different stories tell a version of the faith that's unrecognizable when we compare it to our New Testament Gospels. The Jesus in there doesn't sound like the Jesus in our New Testaments. And of all these different books in the Gnostic Gospels discovery, one stood out among all the others that became maybe the most famous of all the books that's ever been discovered about Jesus outside our canonical four, and that's what's known as the Gospel of Thomas. Many of you know and have heard about the Gospel of Thomas. Well, it was discovered by Muhammad Ali. How's that for something you can tell your friends, right? Did you know the Gospel of Thomas was discovered by Muhammad Ali? They probably will think it's the boxer too. What you realize is what he discovered that day really challenged what you and I believe. Because if you read the Jesus of the Gospel of Thomas, you realize that he doesn't really talk about himself as divine. He actually talks about you and me and human beings sort of as divine. It's rather odd. The Jesus in the Gospel of Thomas doesn't talk about salvation from sin and a sacrifice from sin, but rather he talks about rather than salvation coming from outside you, salvation comes from inside you. It comes from acquiring secret knowledge, sort of comes from enlightenment and something that you can earn and attain. If you were to read the Gospel of Thomas, you would be reading an entirely different version of Christianity. And of course, this raises questions in your mind and in my mind and in many other people's minds since then, and that is very obviously, well, why wasn't the Gospel of Thomas in our New Testaments? Why didn't that make it in the Bible? I mean, maybe Thomas has the right version of Jesus, and maybe Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John have the wrong version of Jesus. I mean, how do I know that our Gospels are the right Gospels anyway? And it wasn't just Thomas that was floating around in the ancient world. There was all these other Gospels floating around in the ancient world. There's the Gospel of Peter, and the Gospel of Philip, and the Gospel of Mary, and the Gospel of Truth, the Gospel of the 12, and the Gospel of this and that. And so we have all these other Gospels. Why would I think that our four are any better than any others? Maybe the Gospels you and I read in our Bibles are just the sort of arbitrary accidents of history. And yeah, we happen to like them, but in another scenario, maybe there'd be different Gospels in our Bibles. Now, all those questions that you are asking in your mind and that I ask too are really important questions to answer. In fact, that's the nub of what I want to talk about, right, in this session with you, is that do we have any reason to think that Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John are in our Bibles for any reason at all? Is it just random? Is it just that some political faction somewhere in early Christianity happened to like them better and then sort of forced them on the church? Is that our explanation? Or is there something about Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John that sets them apart? Well, what I'm going to do today is lay out for you my little case for our Gospels, okay? My little case for our canonical Gospels. I'm going to lay out four things for you this afternoon that I think makes them different, that makes them distinct. In fact, when you hear them, you'll realize when it's all over that, oh, wait, there actually is a reason why these are in our Bibles and not other Gospels. Now, before I get to those four things, though, I want to pause for a moment and sort of rewind the tape and ask a broader question as we get going into this. Rather than just diving into the four historical issues I want to talk with you about, I want to ask a broader question, which I think is really interesting, and that is, why is it that people are so fascinated with lost Gospels in our world today? And it doesn't even take much self-reflection or reflection on our culture to see that that, in fact, is the case. People are genuinely fascinated with lost Gospels. They are mesmerized by them. They can't get enough of them. If I write a book about the canonical Gospels, there'll be a collective yawn. If I write a book about lost Gospels, everyone wants to listen, right? I mean, from the publishing side, I can talk to Brent about this later. I mean, if I want to write a book that sells copies, maybe I ought to write about lost Gospels, not about canonical Gospels. People can't get enough of them. They're fascinated by them. You You see this not just in the academy, but in the popular culture. What do you see that comes up in the news every Christmas and Easter? In some magazine or some news show, what are people always asking? Well, was he really born in a manger? Did Jesus really rise from the dead? And then they start talking about whether you can trust your gospels, and they always end up talking about these so-called lost gospels. Our culture can't get enough. Why is that, I wonder? I want to suggest to you a particular thesis as we get started here that I think can explain our culture's fascination with lost gospels. I have one word I want to throw out for you that I think explains it. One word that I think is a word our culture is fascinated with. It's a word that I think captures the essence of what our culture values and what our culture can't stop talking about, which I think explains their fascination with lost gospels. And that one word is the word diversity. Now, when I talk about diversity in this context, I'm not talking about racial diversity or ethnic diversity. No, that's not what I'm talking about. When I talk about diversity here, I'm talking about the diversity of ideas. That our culture is fascinated with the diversity of religious perspectives. Our culture is fascinated with the diversity of religious truth claims. There's so many different groups out there that all have their idea of what is right and wrong, good and bad, and true and false. And they're all competing against each other. Everyone has a different view on heaven and hell and God and Jesus and salvation and how you go one place and not another and religious books and so on. There's so much diversity everywhere you look in our world today. Now, on one level, that's absolutely true, right? On one level, our culture is correct. If you go on a university campus or just walk across the country or go to any particular city and ask people what they believe about religious matters and God and philosophy and so on, you're going to get a great diversity of answers. That's not even actually disputable. That's actually true. You're going to get a bunch of different answers, probably as many answers as there are people you'll talk to. But here's the trick. What our culture does isn't just simply observe the fact of religious and philosophical diversity. If they only observed it, we would agree that it exists. No one can dispute that. What our culture does, and if you notice this, what our culture does is actually draws a conclusion from the existence of that religious and philosophical diversity. And it's that conclusion that slipped into the argument. It's that conclusion that you actually don't notice they're making. And it's the conclusion that I want to argue does not follow. And here's what the conclusion is. Look at all this religious and philosophical diversity. Look at how many people disagree about who Jesus is and about how you go to heaven or not go to heaven and so on. All of that diversity means, and here's the conclusion, that there can be no one way of truth out there. Or to put it another way, because there's so much diversity, there's no view more right than any other view. There's no view that's more true than any other view. That every view is just as good as every other view. And that there's no reason to think any view should be considered better or more accurate than any other view. In other words, what our culture does, and you don't even notice it, is they don't just observe that people disagree, they draw a conclusion from the fact that people disagree and say there could be, therefore, no one right view. Even if there was a right view, you could never know what it was. You ever notice, though, that the conclusion doesn't necessarily follow from the premise? They make that leap, but is it true that the mere existence of diversity means that it could be no one right view? Does just the mere existence of diverse opinion mean there could be no truth? You realize that that's added to the equation, but it doesn't actually come from the evidence itself. It's simply a philosophical commitment that's just sprinkled in to the discussion. And I want to suggest to you that that cultural world that we swim in, and you know it, right? Every day you watch the news or you read an article on the internet or on the newspaper, you feel that, what I just said to you. Here's the reality. That cultural value has affected the way people study the Gospels. In fact, there was a scholar a number of years ago, and he was ahead of his time, who actually took this theme of diversity and he explored the Gospels in light of that theme. You probably never heard of this scholar before. His name was Walter Bauer. He actually wrote a very famous book in 1934 called Orthodoxy and Heresy in Earliest Christianity. And Bauer, in 1934, wrote this book, and nobody noticed. And the reason that no one noticed is because when he wrote this book, he was in Germany in 1934. If you know anything about what was going on in Germany in 1934, no one was thinking about Walter Bauer, right? They were thinking about this other guy by the name of Adolf Hitler, and everything was going crazy in Europe, and no one was worried about what Walter Bauer was writing. So he wrote this book, and it labored in obscurity for years. And then in 1971, it was translated into English, and suddenly it was like this bomb went off in biblical studies, because here's what Bauer argued. He said that when you go back inside of early Christianity and have a look around in, say, the second and third centuries, there's no such thing as early Christianity. Instead, what you find is early Christianities, plural. In other words, what Bauer says is when you look back in the early centuries of the church, you find a lot of theological, what's the word? Diversity. No one could agree, says Bauer. No one got along. Everybody bickered with each other. Everyone said, we're the right version of Christianity. And then someone over here says, no, we're the right version of Christianity. And everybody had a different theological system, and no one really had any sort of common ground at all. And it was only because one of those theological groups prevailed. One of those groups ended up, if you will, making their way in and found themselves to be successful, if you will, and ended up triumphing in this discussion of Christianity. Only that group is the group that could pick the books that you and I read, so Bauer argued. Here's the trick then. Bauer said, why do you read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John in your Bibles? Because your particular theological group won out of all that diversity. And then he says, well, what if another group had won? What if the Gnostics had won? What books would be in your Bible then? Well, not Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, probably Thomas and Peter and Philip and so on, other Gospels. In other words, the Gospels you read are just historical accidents. They are no better than any other Gospels out there. There's no reason to privilege them over any others, because remember, all these different groups couldn't agree, and if none of them could agree, none of them more right than anybody else, and none of their Gospels are more right than anybody else. Now, that whole narrative I just laid out for you is what thousands and thousands and thousands of university students hear in our country every single week. Universities across the land. And then those students come and they sit in your church or my church or someone else's church, and they're thinking to themselves, yeah, why am I reading Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? Because I was just taught that no gospel is better than another. What you realize then is that this is the cultural, the sort of air we breathe, right? Why are people fascinated with false gospels? Because they're fascinated with diversity of ideas in the first place. And here's the big payoff of the whole thing. Why does this matter so much? This is why. I'm getting ready to tell you. The reason this matters so much to people is because if no gospel is better than another, if all gospels are equally true or equally false, and if I shouldn't prioritize one over another, then I get to choose the Jesus I prefer. Maybe you read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and you're like, I don't really like the Jesus in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. I don't really feel like I agree with him. But I read the Gospel of Thomas, and I actually like the Jesus there. He's telling me what I want to hear. He's actually much more palatable to me, much more likable to me. In fact, if no gospel is better than another, I can just say, well, I prefer the Jesus of Thomas, not the Jesus of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. If it's just all arbitrary, I get to choose, right? This is what we're facing in our culture today, is a situation where we're told that no gospel is better than another, and the payoff is that it doesn't matter what you read, it doesn't matter which Jesus you prefer, you can pick the Jesus you happen to like. Now, that whole narrative is what our world hears. That's what's told in the universities, and I'm sure you've heard versions of it, right? That whole narrative works really well at a rhetorical level. All that I've laid out for you, if we stopped right here and did nothing else, that would work really well, and many people would probably be persuaded by it. But if you start diving into the historical facts about gospels, that narrative disintegrates rather rapidly. That narrative only works as a cultural narrative. It doesn't work as history. When you look at it from a historical perspective, actually, it doesn't bear itself out at all. When you look at it from a historical perspective, and I'm getting ready to tell you what those historical facts are, you'll find out that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are actually quite different than other Gospels, and that we have very good historical reasons for why they're in our Bibles and not these other Gospels. The fact of the matter is most people don't take that second step. They like the narrative. Wouldn't you want to be told that? You can just pick the Jesus you want? Isn't that something that sounds good on the front end? People don't ever actually want to know the historical facts. What I want you to know, though, is the historical facts. And that's what we're going to do here today. Now, as I run through these four, let's dive into the four. You have to realize that, of course, in our remaining time here, I'm not going to give you a full lecture on each of these four points. There's many places to go. I'm just going to run through them rather quickly and sort of lay them out. And then hopefully, even in Q&A time, if you want to go deeper into one of these, we can. But these four, I think, are at least four good reasons to think our Gospels are distinct. By the way, there's not just four reasons. I think these are four very good reasons. There are many more reasons than that. Can't get to all of it here today. But let's just walk through them one at a time. Let's start with the first of the four. First reason why Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are distinctive is simply this. They are, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, what we call our canonical gospels, are the earliest gospels we have. They are the earliest gospels we have. Here's a simple fact for you, and it's the very first of our four facts, and it's a fact that's easy to remember and easy to talk about, and that is Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John take us deeper back in history, further back in time, closest to the person of Jesus, closest to his immediate followers than any other gospel that we have. That's a stunning fact right there. And if you think about it from an historical perspective, if Jesus lived in the first century, wouldn't you want a gospel that was written in the first century? Wouldn't you want a gospel that was written as close to the time of Jesus that it possibly could have been written? Wouldn't you want that the person writing the gospel is at least in some sort of historical proximity to the events he's recording? And so if Jesus lived in the first century and he did his ministry in the first century, wouldn't you want a gospel that was written in the first century? And the answer, of course, is yes. And here's the reality. The only gospels that we have are written in the first century. And we have all these gospels on our shelves, so to speak. There's only four written in the first century. And their names are Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And here's what's remarkable about that fact, is it's not a fact that I made up. It's not a fact that I'm just sort of pretending is a fact. It's actually a fact that's pretty much a scholarly consensus today. That means critical scholars on the one side, evangelical scholars on the other side, actually all agree on this fact that these gospels, our gospels, are the only gospels that go back to the first century. Now, I can tell you this, when it comes to biblical scholars, they don't agree on very much. You stick four or five guys in a room and ask them to talk about something related to religion or history or Bible, and you're not going to get many answers that are on common ground. What's remarkable is across the scope of New Testament studies, there is a near consensus that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are the only Gospels that date to the first century. And what's interesting is to watch that consensus work, because every now and then there'll be a scholar who gets the gumption up to try to date another Gospel to the first century. And usually the Gospel they try to date to the first century is the Gospel we've been talking about, which is the Gospel of Thomas. And every now and then a scholar will say, I'm going to give it another go. I'm going to try again the date of the first century, and they'll try, and then the academy will listen and go, good effort. No. Even critical scholars like Bart Ehrman are like, no, the Gospel of Thomas is not a first century gospel. It just doesn't work. In fact, there's a couple books that just came out in the last couple years on the Gospel of Thomas, one by Mark Goodacre at Duke University, one by Simon Gathicol at Cambridge University, written independently, came out in the same year and had the same conclusion, which is the Gospel of Thomas is dependent on our canonical Gospels and was written in the second century or later. And here's the reality about this, is that that's true for every single other Gospel written. Any other Gospel that you find out there, Gospel of Thomas, Gospel of Peter, Gospel of Philip, all of them, and let this sink in, all of them are written in the second century or later. None of them go back to the first century, to the time of Jesus and his disciples. Now, that fact alone is almost enough. I mean, I mentioned I have four facts tonight about the Gospels that make them unique. I could almost stop my lecture right here. If you were to pick a Gospel, if you said, look, I'm gonna create the ideal Gospel, what would that be? Well, one that's as close as possible. If you had all these Gospels to choose from, wouldn't you choose one that's as close as possible to the events they're purporting to record? The answer is yes. In one sense, we can stop here. Now, there's more that we'll get to in a moment, but this is a great first point to begin with. Now, what are the implications of this point before we leave it? Let me just draw out a couple of them. One I've already sort of have hinted at and even stated, and that is on a historical level, the sort of rule of thumb of history is you want as small a gap as possible between the writing of history and the historical events they're recording. Think about it for a moment. What if the gospel that you are reading about Jesus was written in, say, the 4th century? Would that bother you? Would you care? Now, of course, it's possible to write good history in the 4th century about something in the 1st century, but if you were choosing between a gospel written in the 1st century and a gospel written in the 4th century, which would you prefer? That's the first implication. But there's another implication of this first point before we leave it, and that is something that few people actually reckon with when it comes to the dating of the Gospels. And that is, if you wrote a Gospel in the first century, as opposed to, say, the fourth century, that when you wrote that Gospel and you published that Gospel, there were still eyewitnesses alive and around that could verify or deny what you had written. To put it another way, if you wrote a Gospel in the first century, and there are other people around who witnessed these things, and you just made it up, that's a very risky move. That's a move that you could easily have someone say, well, wait a second, I just read your Gospel. This isn't how it happened. I was there. I actually saw these things. You're just creating this out of whole cloth. And if I wrote a Gospel, say, in the fourth century, then is there anybody around who can refute me? If I wrote a Gospel in the fifth century, could someone stand up and say, wait a second, I was there. No one's left that was there. Here's what I want you to realize is writing history in the first century puts yourself in a very vulnerable position if you're not writing it accurately. Now, people will hear that and go, oh, no one cared about history in the ancient world. No one paid attention to such things. That's not true. Actually, there's an incredible number of books that scholars have written about the way ancient people wrote history and actually critiqued bad history and actually pulled out historical documents from other people and say, this is lousy history. There's no eyewitnesses here. There's no good investigation here. Actually, people are very careful about history of the ancient world. And if you were going to pick a book, you would pick one that was close as possible to the events they're purporting to record. And if you yourself care about that, there's only one set of Gospels in play, and that is Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And that's the first one. Sometime later, when you're talking to your non-Christian friend, and they say, well, what makes your Gospel so great? You're like, well, I'm no biblical scholar, but I know one thing. Dr. Kruger said four things. I don't remember the other three, but I know one thing. The earliest Gospels we have. If nothing else, you can at least take that away. Okay, let me mention a second thing that makes our Gospels unique. First, is it the earliest Gospels we have? That's sort of the when question, okay? The when question. Secondly, our canonical Gospels are unique because they have what I would call a credible connection to the apostles. A credible connection to the apostles. In other words, the second point I want you to see is not just a when question, it's a who question. It's not just when they are written, but who they are written by. And we want to argue here that only our Gospels have a shot of having been written by a real eyewitness. Or if not an eyewitness, someone who was standing next to, effectively, an eyewitness and got that account directly. In other words, we're going to argue that only the canonical Gospels have a shot of taking you back to the closest friends of Jesus. And here's where we come to this theme of gospel authorship. We want to argue, and there's lots of reasons to make this argument, that our four Gospels are actually written either by apostles, who were the best friends of Jesus, if you want to think about that way, or by the immediate companions of apostles, Matthew and John being part of the inner circle of Jesus, and Luke and Mark being part of that broader circle that would have known and been partners with those same individuals. Now, people ask all the time, well, who are the apostles exactly? How do you define the apostles? Well, there's a whole big theological, historical discussion there. But as I said, I think the simple definition is they're Jesus' closest friends. They're the ones who lived with him, traveled with him, were commissioned by him, and sent out to speak for him. They're the ones that delivered Jesus' message to the later generations. They were the ones who were his inner circle. Now, of course, you could say, well, why do I care about that? Well, imagine for a moment that you walked into a bookstore and you were looking for, let's say, a biography of Abraham Lincoln. And there you looked on the bookshelf and you saw a biography of Abraham Lincoln that was anonymous. And you saw a biography of Abraham Lincoln that was written by his best friend. And you could take only one book home. Which would you pick? Of course, you know the answer to that. You're thinking, well, I could pick the anonymous biography of Abraham Lincoln, but if I could get a biography of Abraham Lincoln written by his best friend who was there when he did what he did, that was there when he signed the Emancipation Proclamation, perhaps, or when he witnessed all the things unfolding in the late 19th century and was part of this very key moment in American history, someone who was boots on the ground who saw it happen, would you not want a biography written by that person? That's effectively what we have in the canonical Gospels. But of course, this raises a larger question in people's minds. How do we know who wrote the canonical Gospels? Take the Gospel of John for a moment. It's got the title, the Gospel according to John, on it, and it's attributed to John. Okay, fair enough. But how do I know that it's really John who wrote it, you might ask, right? I mean, it says it's from John, but how do I know it's from John? Of course, as I said already, these are larger discussions we can't fully unpack here. But one of the best ways we know in historical studies who wrote the Gospels is not just by the names on them. That's an important piece of evidence, right? But another piece of important evidence is also the earliest testimony of those first generation Christians who would have access to that information. In other words, as far back as we can see, we want to ask the question, who did they think wrote that gospel? And actually, here is where it's a good example of the kind of amazing evidence we have for the canonical four. When it comes to the Gospel of John, for example, we know that John wrote it for all kinds of reasons, but one of the earliest church fathers in the second century, by the name of Irenaeus, says plainly John wrote John, right? Effectively, the person who wrote John was John, the son of Zebedee, the one who laid his head on the chest of Jesus at the Last Supper. That guy is the one who wrote the gospel that bears his name. Okay, you have it right there. Now the next question is, well, why should I think that Irenaeus in the second century got that right? Maybe he got it wrong. Maybe he made it up. Of course, if you do that historical investigation, you start pulling the string, you realize, well, where did Irenaeus get his information from? Well, he got it from an earlier church father who discipled him, who was his mentor. And who was that? A guy by the name of Polycarp. Well, do I think Polycarp knows anything about John's gospel? Well, yeah, you know why? Because you know who Polycarp's mentor was? John himself. So get this straight. John the Apostle himself mentors a person by the name of Polycarp, who mentors Irenaeus. And Irenaeus tells us that the gospel was written, that we have that name John, it was written by John. Now you could say, well, he got it wrong, but he's only one step removed from John himself, just one step removed. Now on a historical level, that's an amazing chain of historical evidence. If you were a trial lawyer, you're loving that scenario, right? Because it's all in your favor. You're saying, look, could he have made it up? It's possible. Could he have lied? Sure, lots of things are possible. But what's likely historically? Likely historically, we have good reasons to think that John wrote John. Now, what are the implications of this second point? A couple really big ones here. Let me just lay it out. First implication is that the canonical Gospels contain and are the only ones we have any reason to think contain eyewitness authoritative testimony. Now notice I used two words there. First of all, I used eyewitness testimony, which is obvious. If you're there, you can see it and you can report it. But notice it's not just that the apostles provide eyewitness testimony. They provide authoritative eyewitness testimony. Why? Because they were actually commissioned by Jesus to tell his story. You can think of it as their official biographers, right? It's like you have all these unauthorized biographies. You know, whenever you hear an unauthorized biography, you're like, eh, I don't know if I trust that. But here you have an authorized, commissioned, sent out biography, in effect, by someone who's actually there. Once again, if you could get that versus some anonymous gospel, which would you pick? Here's the other implication, though, from this second point, which is really key. And that is no apocryphal gospel could even come close to making this claim. Our canonical gospels are the only ones that have a shot at being written by an eyewitness, an apostle. And the corollary of that is none of those other gospels have any shot at all. Why do they not have any shot at all? Well, actually, that goes back to the first point, because they're all written in the second century or later. Remember, they could not have been written by an apostle or in a companion of an apostle, because by the time they're written, all those people were dead. So it's not as simple as simply saying that the canonical gospels are the only one with eyewitness authoritative testimony. The corollary of that is all these other competitors have no shot at that. None, because all of them are written in the second century and even in the third century and fourth century and beyond. None of them could have been written by the actual names they bear. People ask me all the time, why was Gospel of Thomas called the Gospel of Thomas? I mean, did Thomas really write it? Well, according to what we're arguing here, Thomas could not have written it. Thomas was long dead when the Gospel of Thomas was written. Obviously, it took that name and attached it to it. And you can see why. I mean, if you're writing a gospel in the second century and you wanted to get some attention for it, what would you call it, right? You wouldn't call it Bob's Gospel, right, in the second century. You're like, why would I read that? You're going to take a famous name and attach it to it. That's exactly what happened here. Don't think that names like the Gospel of Thomas or the Gospel of Peter mean these gospels or at all written by the names they bear. We know they couldn't have been by virtue of their late date. Okay, that leads me to a third thing I want to lay out in terms of what makes our Gospels unique. First was they were the earliest we have. Second, they're the only ones that go back to the apostles. Third, and this is a key one, the canonical Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, lack the legendary embellishments of later Gospels. They lack the legendary embellishments of later Gospels. Let me explain what I mean by this. Most people who read the canonical Gospels don't have an appreciation for the type of history you're reading. It's actually a very restrained, very matter-of-fact, very direct reporting style in our canonical Gospels that it never dawns on us that it's like that because we have really nothing to compare it to. In fact, it's only when you compare it to these other Gospels, what we call apocryphal Gospels, that you realize how unique the canonical four are. Now, when I say restrained and matter of fact, you're thinking, well, what do I mean when I say that? I'll give you a couple of examples that may help fill this in. The Gospels that we read, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, what's interesting about them is not only what they tell us, it's also interesting to note what they don't tell us, what they leave out. And the things they leave out are actually the things you might expect to have been included in a gospel you were making up. And let me explain what I mean. Here's one example for you. Have you ever noticed when you read the canonical Gospels that you never actually see Jesus rising from the dead? You don't see it happening. When you read the canonical Gospels and the women show up to the tomb to find the resurrection, it's already happened. It's over, right? When they get there, it's over. The scene is done. The stones roll back. They go in and they see the empty tomb. Yes, but you don't actually see the resurrection taking place. You don't actually see Jesus coming out of the tomb. No one actually saw it in the canonical Gospels. Now, you could think for a moment, if I were making up a story of Jesus of Nazareth and the resurrection was my big crescendo, that was the big icing on the cake, maybe I ought to have someone standing there watching it. Maybe I ought to have somebody who could see it taking place and say, yeah, I saw, he just walked right out of there. Here's what's amazing about the canonical Gospels, they don't do that. The very thing you think they would have included, they don't. The very thing you'd think that would be it, the thing you would want most of anything is to see it happen, but all they say is the women showed up and it was already over, almost like as if that's what happened. So you think about restraint, that's a good example. I'll give you another example of restraint. One of the other things that people wonder about is not only why you don't see the resurrection, another thing in the canonical Gospels people wonder about is why don't we hear more about Jesus as a little kid? You ever wonder what Jesus was like as a boy? As a child growing up, the canonical Gospels gives us preciously little. In fact, the grand total of one story of Jesus as a boy, which is the story in Luke when he's in the temple, right? Other than that, you get nada, zero, nothing. And you're wondering, well, golly, how'd he get along with his brothers and sisters, right? Did he ever get in trouble? You might wonder, how many times did his brothers and sisters hear the phrase, why can't you be more like your brother Jesus, right? Or something like this. And you wonder, what was Jesus like as a little kid? Gospels tell you nothing. Now, when you think about those two examples of the restraint in the Gospels, here's what's curious. When you read the apocryphal Gospels, those Gospels that were written later outside our New Testaments, they actually fill in the gaps for you. In fact, this is one of the reasons we know they're late. We know they're late because they're actually filling in the gaps left by the canonical ones. And you realize, oh, they're scratching that itch that I wanted scratched, and they're basically filling it in for you. So if you want to know what it looks like for Jesus to rise from the dead, there's a gospel that gives that to you. It's called the Gospel of Peter. The Gospel of Peter gives you the live videotape of Jesus walking out of the tomb. You've been waiting for it. There it is. See, now you've got it. Here's what's interesting about it, though, is that when you read the Gospel of Peter, you're thinking, finally, I got a gospel of Jesus, you know, walking out of the tomb. But then you realize, oh, wait, something is really weird here. It was really off here. And you realize the amount of legendary embellishments piled on this gospel are unbelievable, and you would not have noted them unless you had read it. What happens? Well, yes, Jesus comes out of the tomb in the Gospel of Peter, but when he comes out of the tomb, he's not the Jesus you remember. He's a giant Jesus. He's a super tall Jesus. He's a 60-foot Jesus. He's a Jesus whose head touches the clouds Jesus. Is what I tell my students. He's Godzilla Jesus coming out of the tomb. And it gets weirder in the Gospel of Peter. Not only does giant Jesus come out of the tomb, but following giant Jesus out of the tomb is the cross itself. The cross is following Jesus out of the tomb. And of course, that raises all kinds of questions. How did the cross get in the tomb in the first place? It's not like when you die in the Roman world, they let you take the cross with you when you die. It's like, here's a gift when you go. They will take this cross with you. You don't know how it got in the tomb in the first place, but then how does it follow Jesus out of the tomb? Is the cross walking? Is it floating? We don't know. Then you think that's bad, it gets even worse. Then the cross starts talking in the Gospel of Peter. So now you've got the giant Jesus, the floating, talking cross, and you're like, oh, wait a second. Now I see what's different about the canonical four and these other Gospels. Now, if you're a guy or a girl that likes to think about Jesus as a little kid, there's a Gospel for you too. It's called the Infancy Gospel of Thomas, not to be confused with the Gospel of Thomas. This is called the Infancy Gospel of Thomas, and it's got all the stories of Jesus as a boy. You're like, okay, finally, now I know. But this is, something's weird here too. You read this, and you're like, this is strange. This little Jesus guy in the Infancy Gospel of Thomas is a bit scary. He's a bit terrifying. He's like a little hellion terrifying his village, right? In one particular account in the Infancy Gospel of Thomas, he actually kills another child who upsets him. And then when the town comes and confronts this boy Jesus about it, he raises him from the dead, right? I mean, he's a very scary Jesus in this story, and there's all kinds of other legendary embellishments in that as well. Here's what you realize. You realize that most people think that all Gospels are equal because they've actually never read the other Gospels. In fact, most people have never even read the canonical Gospels. I mean, let's just think about this room for a second. How many in here have read, not just heard of, have actually read the Gospel of Peter? Yeah, you don't count. You're a former student, right? So zero. How many in here have not just heard of but read the Infancy Gospel of Thomas? Okay, a couple. What you realize is when people sort of tout the, remember the narrative? Oh, all Gospels are the same. There's no difference between the Gospels. It's one or the other. Oh, wait a second. I've never read them. And when you read them, you realize, oh, there is a qualitative difference between what you read in our Gospels and what you read in these other Gospels. And you realize not only that, but the gaps left in our Gospels are the very gaps filled in by the apocryphal Gospels. How curious is that? It tells you that one is primary, one is secondary. Okay, that leads me to my fourth and final point here. So we've got three so far. Our Gospels are the earliest we've got. Second, they're the only ones that have a connection to the apostles. Third, they're the ones that lack the later obvious embellishment of these apocryphal texts. And then fourthly, our canonical Gospels were the ones the early church recognized as authoritative at a very early date. In other words, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were the Gospels that were recognized by the earliest Christians. You see, this fourth point raises a different question, right? If we want to ask about whether one gospel is different than another gospel, here's a way we could ask the question. We could ask the question this way. Which gospels did the earliest Christians prefer? They were the ones that lived during this time period. They're the ones that were close to the apostles. Many of them knew the apostles. Which books did they read? Now, what you'll hear the modern narrative say is, oh, no one knew what to read in the ancient world. Everybody read whatever they wanted to read. It was a total literary free-for-all. It was this, you read this, and you read that, and no one had a canon, and no one had a collection of books, and so on. I can't answer that fully here. I've written several books, actually, about that very thing, and you can go read them if you want to do that. I can tell you this. When it comes to the four Gospels, that narrative completely falls apart when you look at the historical evidence. Is it really true that it was a literary free-for-all and everyone just read what they wanted to read? Here's a couple examples. Irenaeus, our friend again, one of the most prominent church fathers in the second century. What did he say about the Gospels? Interestingly, he said there was four and only four. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. About the same time, our earliest canonical list called the Muratorian Fragment actually lists out the Gospels. Which ones does it list? Well, look at that. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Four and only four. Clement of Alexandria, also at the late second century, a very prominent church father. How many Gospels do you think were belonged in the New Testament? Actually, four and only four, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So apparently in the early church, it wasn't sort of this literary free-for-all. Apparently, actually, it was fairly clear that the books that people were reading were these books, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. What about the apocryphal Gospels? People read those? Well, some people were clearly reading them, right? Because we have copies of them, so someone somewhere read them. But what's curious is that when they were mentioned by the church fathers, they were not mentioned as other great gospels too. When it comes to things like the Gospel of Thomas, for example, the Gospel of Thomas was mentioned only to be condemned. The church fathers knew it was out there,
and they either condemned it or ignored it. This idea that apocryphal gospels were as popular or as well-read as our canonical gospels just doesn't square with the historical facts. Here's a couple tidbits for you that drive this home if you haven't really thought about this. We have a lot of gospel manuscripts in the ancient world that combine gospels together, that hold multiple gospels in the same book. We don't have a single manuscript anywhere in early Christianity, anywhere, that combines apocryphal and canonical gospels. Isn't that an interesting fact? So we don't have a codex anywhere that has, say, Matthew, Mark, and Thomas, or Matthew, Luke, and Peter. Whenever you find the canonical gospels, it's always Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Here's another interesting thing. We don't have a canonical list that does that. There's all these Christians that started writing out the books they liked and all the different lists we have of the books they preferred and they liked. We don't have anything that mixes canonical and apocryphal material. No one says, I like Matthew, Mark, and Thomas. No one anywhere ever says that. Completely not there. And I think the most telling fact in all of this is simply the number of manuscripts we've discovered of these books. The number of manuscripts left behind in the sands of Egypt, so to speak, tell us how popular books were, how much they were read, and how much they were copied. When it comes to the canonical Gospels, we have thousands of copies. What's interesting is that when you look at the Gospel of Thomas, we have a grand total of 3 in the ancient world. 3. In fact, what's interesting is that Muhammad Ali didn't even find one of the 3, because Muhammad Ali actually found a copy of Thomas in Coptic, not in Greek. All the canonical Gospels I mentioned were always in Greek. All right, let me pull this together as we sort of summarize what we're doing here. What has our agenda been here? Our agenda has been simple, and that's we're just simply asking the question, do we have any reason to think that our Gospels are any different than any other Gospels? Or is the narrative we hear about all Gospels being the same, that diversity rules the day in terms of ideas, that, you know, you can just pick whatever Gospel you prefer because they're no different, no one's better than another? Is that the answer? It works until you look at the historical evidence. When you look at the historical evidence, it just doesn't work. In fact, when you look at the historical evidence, everything we see points back towards Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John being different. They're the earliest, they go back to the apostles, they lack that legendary embellishment, and they're the ones the early church received uniformly from the very earliest moment. Now, when you look at all that, you think to yourself, wait a second, oh, maybe they're actually in our Bibles for a reason. Maybe it wasn't just an accident of history. They actually have a reason to think Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are the ones I should listen to. And of course, the payoff of that is very important, right? There's no more important question that a person will ever ask, and probably no more important question they will ever answer than the question, who is Jesus? And what we learn from this is that if you want to answer to that question, there are sources for you, but there's not an endless number of them. The early church recognized there's 4 places you go if you want to know who Jesus is. You go to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Okay, I got a few minutes here at the very tail end of this before we take our break. Brent, help me with the time. Maybe 5 minutes for questions. Is that good? What are we looking at here? Okay. Okay. So ask good ones, please, right? If you ask a boring question, I'm shutting it down here. All right, in the back. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Actually, this is a very common argument made within historical circles. It's actually the second part, not the first, though. So you got 2 issues when you write a biography. One is you've got to have facts, and then so you've got to be historically within proximity to get those facts. Okay, so do historians value a gospel that's written as close as possible in time? Yeah, because you've got to have some reliable link to the data you're culling, right? Could you theoretically get reliable data 500 years later? Yeah, but not as reliable. So typically that's not something they worry about. But they do worry about the second thing, right? They think, oh, you can't trust these gospel authors. They got an agenda. They got an axe to grind. Or as you put it, they like Jesus too much, right? You can't trust people who are too close to things. And if they're too close, they got a vested interest, well, you need to find some third-party neutral person. Now, There's all kinds of reasons or ways we could push back against that. First of all, I'm like, well, go find me a neutral person. I'm looking forward to meeting them because I've never met one. Okay, this idea of a disinterested third party doesn't exist, and I think we could go down that route philosophically of this supposed neutral history. I don't think there is anything. Secondly, I would argue that why would we think neutral history is necessarily better history? I mean, if you saw Jesus rise from the dead, are you neutral? No, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't be listened to. Some things are so amazing or so amazingly bad that even if you're caught up in it and you're biased, quote unquote, about it, that doesn't make your testimony unreliable. I mean, if we wrote that out, we'd basically have to say something like this. When we do a history of the Holocaust, we shouldn't listen to Holocaust survivors and get their story. Why? Because they're too close to it. They're too biased. They're going to be negative to the Germans. You know, we can't trust them. We need to get some third party to tell us what happened. Of course, that's crazy. If you go to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., almost all the testimonies there are Holocaust survivors, right? Were they too close? No, they've got a vested interest in seeing justice done, do they not? I mean, could they exaggerate the claims because they wanted to get back at the Germans? I mean, that kind of argument's crazy. So I think you could find ways to push back against that sort of thing. I don't know of any historical biography that's supposedly neutral. And I don't think they necessarily would want one. So good question, though, to get us rolling. See, we don't have to stop right now. We had a good question. See, that's good. Way to go. Yep. Did you say consistency or inconsistency? Among gospel to gospel or consistency within a gospel? Yeah, I think probably the closest thing that comes to that is we do seem to have a strain of what we call Gnostic-like gospels. And what I mean by that is they all seem to reflect a broader Gnostic theology. Now, Gnostic theology is a slippery term and very broad and vague, I know, and there's all kinds of dispute about it in the academic circles, but sticking with it for a moment, there does seem to be a number of Gospels that reflect a certain consistent Gnostic theology and themes about how the world was made, a false god or negative god that made it, that the physical world and matter is evil, and that you're released from some sort of secret higher enlightenment knowledge. That spans multiple Gospels. And I think it does because there was heretical movements in early Christianity that would have taught that. Yes. Right. Yeah, actually, Ehrman's written extensively on this. His most probably detailed work on this is in his book, Jesus Interrupted, which I reviewed at length, and you can get my review on my website. It was also published, but I also keep it on my website. Obviously, I can't go through individual accounts here and sort of work through them. What I will say, though, is that the so-called discrepancies in the resurrection account, some people think as evidence against eyewitnesses, actually disagree, and other historians have made this point. They think that, you know, if you get too many accounts that look exactly the same sort of rote repetition of each other, you get the sense that they've collaborated or they've fixed their story to look a certain way. If you actually have real independent testimony, you're going to have a first glance look at it like, oh, I'm not sure how testimony A fits with testimony B. Now, when you dig down deeper, you find out they're reconcilable, right? But at first glance, it's not a surprise why you might think they're not reconcilable. Now, Ehrman, of course, doesn't think they are. I disagree. There's been a great book written on this. The last name of the author is Morrison. I think his first name is Frank. I can't remember. Called Who Moved the Stone? If you want to go deeper into the resurrection accounts, he actually goes through effectively line by line in the resurrection accounts and talks about how actually they make sense when you start looking at all the different details. Lots of times people who say there's contradictions in the Gospels tend to focus on whether they meet modern historiographical standards, and I think they don't. I don't think we should expect them to meet modern historiographical standards because I think that's a false standard for them to meet. They're often, you know, chronologically out of order, don't necessarily have the precision we expect, but that doesn't mean they're mistaken. So I refer you to my review for more of that. Good. Questions? Others before we move on? Yes.
Is there a current cultural objection to absolute truth?
Yes. I don't think there's any doubt that there's a current cultural objection to absolute truth. I think the irony is that they're absolutely sure about their objection to it. So it ends up being sort of the Achilles heel of the whole argument. The philosophical community has gone round and round on the incoherence and inconsistency of relativism. The problem is that the average Joe out there, so to speak, doesn't know that. And so they continue to speak this way, even though it's not a coherent way to talk. But it makes for good rhetoric, you know, this idea that no one can know anything. If no one can know anything, I couldn't know that I couldn't know anything. And so there's a sense in which you realize it's really self-defeating. I tell my students it's like sawing off the branch you're sitting on, you know, relativism. It ended up hurting yourself as a result. Couple other questions before we wrap up our session here. Yep. Yeah, actually, pretty consistent, the Academy's view on it. So if you didn't hear the question, he's asking how old is our earliest copy of John and how far after the autograph is that? The autograph refers to the original copy of John. From what we can tell, John was probably written in probably around 90 AD, is the last gospel written. And our earliest copy of John is a little fragment called Papyrus 52, P52, which is dated between 100 and 150. So most scholars just call it, to split the difference, 125 AD. So you got John written around 90, and you've got our earliest fragment of John in 125. So 35 years. Now that is a stunningly small amount of time in antiquity to have a book that we have a copy of that far from, only a few years from its original publication. That's sort of the, if you want to think about the average gap of time between when a book was written in our earliest extant copy, the average gap of time is probably between 500 and 1,000 years, to put it in perspective. A good example of this would be sort of, you know, Gallic War or maybe even Josephus. You know, typically you can have a 10th century manuscript to be our earliest copy from something written in the first century. So that kind of gap's stunning. And of course, what's interesting is that we have other copies of John not that much later. P66 is late 2nd century, just a few years later, and it's almost the entire Gospel of John. So, in fact, I have an elective I do at RTS where I actually take my students through P66 and we read photographic images of the manuscript together in class. And we always start with the prologue because that's where you start in the Gospel of John, right? And every year it's the same comment. If we read through the prologue together and they're like, wow, this is exactly like our prologue now. And I'm like, yeah, that's exactly the point, you know? It hasn't changed. So it's a remarkably consistent thing. All right, one more question, then we'll wrap it up for anyone who wants to take the last one here. Yes. Giant Jesus, yes. Yeah. Yeah, so our claim here isn't just, wow, a miraculous thing is what we're talking about. If you see something miraculous, you know it's late. That's not the claim. The claim is, in particular, building on gaps left by the canonical Gospels, okay? So that technique, I think, very much shows not only lateness, but then building on it. So you have something late, filling the gaps, and making it extravagant. The giant Jesus, in particular, actually, is got a theological explanation. Why is it that Jesus enters the tomb in a normal body, quote-unquote, but exits the tomb in a non-normal body, right? So he exits the tomb. He doesn't have a body like you and me because you and me can't touch the clouds with our head, right? So there's a sense that the Gospel of Peter has what's called a docetic theology, docetism. Docetism was a second century heresy that rejected the idea that Jesus that came in the flesh. He wasn't really in the body. That actually helps us date Thomas because a lot of those heresies didn't emerge in that way until the second century. I'm sorry, not date Thomas, date Peter in that instance. So those are some things we look at, but you're right, that we're not suggesting that every amazing miracle isn't necessarily evidence of lateness. But what you see is sort of a layering on details on prior, earlier miracles that we're pointing to, I think are indicative of that.